You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Kaysan, very much, if you're a Marine, you've seen it, no doubt, in the news. The 50th anniversary of the commencement of that 77-day campaign, that battle, was about a week ago. And so, a man who needs really no introduction on this, on this radio program, Order Marines, joins us, author of Many Things Marine, Eric Hamill. So, Eric, first of all, good morning and thanks for doing this.
It's good to be back.
All right. How are things in Northern California? Are you guys surviving?
We're surviving. The temperature hasn't gotten too low or too high.
All right.
That's where we used to be.
That's always a good thing. I want to, before we talk about Kaysan, I want to walk through a couple things. One is, when you write, do you have a template in your head that you use where you go, for instance, you go to strategic situation and general history, the personalities in terms of chain of command, and then we begin to develop the units that are involved in the things that you write about. Do you have a template? How do you approach it, or is everyone different?
Everyone's different once the research is done. I mean, I got to do a certain amount of research firmly implanted in my brain as anchor points for the narrative. And it's something I write in narrative. Kaysan happens to be oral history. But I basically built a framework and then add to that framework progressively, so it kind of keeps expanding until it's done, and then I go back and I smooth it out, cut, you know, check myself out, so forth and so on. But that's the quick, easy, short story.
All right. How do you write it? Who's your audience? Is it anybody can pick up the book and understand it? Is it written predominantly for people who enjoy military history?
Yeah, it's written as popular history. It's written for the people. It's not academic. I don't do academic. I'm actually a little opposed to academic, but at least what I call academentia. You get into arguments with academics. I got into an argument the other day over the use of Wikipedia with professional historians. I guess I'm a professional historian too, but I'm not on that side of the line. And I had to explain why I use Wikipedia, why I'm glad to use Wikipedia, for example. This book was written before Kaysan, Siege in the Clouds is the book. It was written before Wikipedia was even a gleam in daddy's eye.
All right, so every book is a different blueprint for you.
Well, every book has its own set of problems. For example, I completed a book fairly recently, within the last couple of months, and it was a World War II book where everybody in the book died before I got to them. So I could only use sources that have been laid down before they died.
Right.
That was unusual. That's the first time that ever happened to me, but that's the way it's going to go if I keep writing World War II, and I'm working on another World War II book now. So I have to find out, you know, I can't, what I used to do is go out and flood the end zone with letters or calls to people who were there and then sort them out. Usually I'd get about 100 responses and about, you know, 70 of those would work out for useful material. Some people can tell better stories than others about their own lives. Some people don't have a clue what happened to them, but they try to help, and it gets terrible. You know, there's all these relationships you wind up with, most of them good, some of them a little sour. But it depends on the material you're getting. And while that material is coming in, I've been at this long enough, I'm doing a strategy on how to present the material, what I have at that moment. It may change. I get insights. People say things I never thought of. And I dig deeper. So while I'm writing, I'm also researching. While I'm researching, I'm also writing.
How did this book, what made you want to write about Kaysan? How did this get into your head? Where did it come from?
Good friend who was a company commander at Kaysan. He introduced me to other people who were his friends. And I had a basis for a book in these people. And I liked the way they talked about it or wrote about it. And that's what led to the oral history. Oral history was pretty down at this point. Studs Terkel had done a couple of books. I think he did a terrible job, personally. There was just long tracks of people's lives, one after the other, just stacked up like cordwood. And it doesn't give a sense of humans relating to their experiences amongst themselves or by themselves. So I got this fairly colorful group of guys telling me stuff. And the technology was there for me to, for example, tape my telephone. I got myself enough material, including written sources, some official sources to keep the narrative pinned down within bounds.
Right.
And I developed an oral history. I did it by, and this is the way the book is laid out. It's laid out chronologically, but people get onto subjects. For example, rats took up a certain amount of time. You know, rats living in the bunkers.
Right.
So I have a couple of guys who are not around to be with each other talking about rats in the bunkers, and it sounds like a bull session about rats in the bunkers. I have a fire support coordination center. It was a day guy and a night guy. The night guy was killed in a fire long before I saw the material he left behind. He was a good writer. And the day guy I found when I was at 29 Palms. He was chief of staff of the base, a colonel at that point. He'd been a major at KSLAN. And I actually was able to create what would have amounted to a conversation between the two of them. One of them long dead but left behind good material, and one of them there to answer questions. So throughout the book, there's little takes of these two discussing their craft, the differences between night and day. Oh. A little creative.
Well, no, I would imagine that I would use the term stumble into things as you, in your research, as you did, trying to find a way to leverage this and make it come alive and validate it and talk about the differences. Your creativeness is probably one of your strengths as a writer.
Go ahead.
No, I was done.
I'm sorry?
I was done. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. One of the things I was allowed to do, or at least I allowed myself to do, was to take topics you wouldn't normally discuss because they're sort of inside baseball stuff. But when a person is telling the story, when he's being quoted, and you can hear him clearing his throat and all that, it was just too good to not put into the regular narrative. So it's got all these little asides. That's what's on a veteran's mind after the fact. You know, like, isn't this cool? And it was. A lot of it was cool. So I get a little story about ice cream that arrived, and they couldn't decide how to divvy up the ice cream, so they let it melt and nobody got it.
The democratic way.
This is democratic. It's the marine way.
Exactly. It doesn't matter. It can all melt.
No
out
ice
there.
Cream for anybody.
Right.
50 Puller wrote that in 1943.
There you go. Well, there you go. Straight from the burning bush. What during the Ken Burns, Lynn Novick documentary on the Vietnam War that was released last fall, they talk about Kaysan as strategically a diversion designed to pin down American troops, an effort while the rest of Tet happened. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, the North Vietnamese had their imperatives, and we had our imperatives. And the North Vietnamese imperatives was to take over the two northern provinces in South Vietnam. That was their political objective, and they were taking towns because those towns were government centers, Hue, Khe Sanh Village, and they were attempting to make sure that the nexus of the Ho Chi Minh Trail was open. So pinning guys in a fire base set to protect the corner of the country that where Laos, Cambodia, and South Vietnam commingle at borders. They wanted to hold down what would have amounted to the strategic reserve in Northern I Corps and in Quang Tri Province. Our imperative was to hold an electronic intelligence station with a radio tower on one of the hills. And the weird part about that radio tower was it was only guarded by a platoon. It was never molested. So we were guarding an asset. Now, that has nothing to do with the operational plan, which was to draw, well, it was staked bait. The troops at Khe Sanh were staked bait. They were all in artillery bands. They were all covered by air pretty much all the time, mm-hmm. even in bad weather. Not terrible weather, but bad enough weather. And the idea was to pin the North Vietnamese down by their volition. They wanted to be pinned down. They cried out to be pinned down because they laid siege to the base. And they had a long plan for taking it. It wasn't going to be over. It couldn't be overrun. There were two phases. The assault phase, and then where many of the hills, there were only about six or seven hills that were covered, were assaulted. None of them were fell. One came very close to the base, but it didn't, and that was the last time they came out to play. And then there was the siege phase, where they literally did all the stuff that armies in the Middle Ages did. I don't know the names of all of it. I'm not an engineer, but they did a classic siege, which occupied them, kept them busy, but they weren't going to win. They weren't going to win because we had air and we had artillery. They had artillery too, but they had no air.
Do you believe that, you don't believe then that this was some kind of diversion, that this was part of the systematic taking of provincial capitals and political spheres of influence on the part of the NDA?
That was the general uprising part of it, of the North Vietnamese strategy. But Khe Sanh itself wasn't really emblematic of there was nothing strategic about it. It was more an in my mind, it was more operational. The only strategic asset that we had there was that radio tower.
Right, and then the airfield went in, and then.
Well, the airfield was there pretty much from the beginning, before there was. I'm pretty sure. I don't know this for sure, but I'm pretty sure it would have been there before the tower went up. I mean, the base wasn't there necessarily to support the tower. The base was there to be a base, but it also took under its wing and provided the platoon to guard the tower.
And also, the other function was a fire support base, yes?
There was the fire support, but there was better fire support at where the Army 175s were. Was it Marble Mountain? No, it couldn't have been Marble Mountain.
No, it wasn't.
I'm having a brain.
No, that's all right. That's all right. Well, all right. Before we talk about the events at Khe Sanh, I've seen wildly different numbers relative to estimated NDA casualties. Is there a best number as you came across?
Never ran across a good number.
No, okay. All right.
I mean, when you had arc light rays against battalions moving from one place to another, where nobody gets to where they were going. You know, how do you count that?
Right.
I mean, how do you count it within a factor of 10?
No, and that's all. That's always been, you know, the discussion is that based on the amount of fighting and the units that were identified in the region, and then those who were no longer seen, the only attributable outcome was they were destroyed at Khe Sanh. And one of the, I think probably the most interesting thing for me anyway, relative to the Vietnam War series on PBS was, I thought they did a great job in finding NVA, Viet Cong, veterans and talking to them. And they talked about how they had to fight us and how they had to get us by the belt buckle and stay close because if there was any distance, you know, and they described, you know, what it was like to be caught in American firepower, and it was horrendous. I mean, and they talked,
it was horrendous.
They talked about retreating back to the Ho Chi Minh Trail where there were, you know, base camps and guys just laying in their hammocks and refusing to get out. And they were ultimately evacuated back to the north.
Well, it gave a new understanding to the deaths of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oh my God, yeah. And they talked. One guy talked about what it was like to be napalm, to be engulfed by fire. Everybody was on fire, and then he's sitting there, and now he'd be you know in his 70s easily, right? And so. Late 60s, 70s now, and you see him talking about how, you know, how important it was to get close, to stay close, so that they could not do this to you, and how terrifying it was once they did. So interesting. But again, the casualty figures are so wild. I just wondered if you had come across a best figure, and it's clear you have not. My guest today, Eric Hamill. How many different volumes about the Marine Corps have you written?
About the Marine Corps, 35, 40, including pictorials.
And we're talking about Khe Sanh as we go down memory road with a lot of people, and his book is entitled Khe Sanh, Siege in the Clouds, an Oral History by Eric Hamill, and you can it's out again, yes.
Yeah, I would like to mention that it is its release as a trade paperback reprint is imminent. Should be out by the end of the week.
All right, there you have it.
And
we hope. So, but where did people find? Where would they find it?
Amazon, probably Barnes and Noble.
Okay, all right. So all your favorite booksellers ought to have it. And again, it's called Khe Sanh, Siege in the Clouds, an Oral History, by Eric Hamill, E-R-I-C-H-A-M-M-E-L. If you're searching for it, talk to us about some of the things that when you think about Khe Sanh as a writer, as an author, as you put your work together, what was important for you to include in the book?
Well, it's always about the people with me. It's about the people and how what they did fit together. So I'm looking to explain the battle or the contest to people who may have no interest in it beyond the fact that they might know somebody who was there or now that they're the children of somebody who was there. I got little old ladies calling me up for explanations of stuff that I wrote. It's kind of not off-putting, but it's kind of strange. They've never read a military book in their life, but their grandnephew was there or something like that, and they want to understand it better.
Wow, that's cool.
Well, it is cool. It is cool. It gives new life to a book. That's why it's been reprinted. I found a publisher who wanted to write on the 50-year cycle. All the military history is in a multi-year cycle. It comes and it goes, it comes and it goes. There's days or weeks or months or years you can't give a book away. And then there's the other days and months and years you can't keep it in stock long enough to put it in your inventory control sheet.
The talk to me, so as you tell a story, first of all, do you mind giving us the name of the company commander who you first talked to? That
can't. Well, a guy who I accidentally turned into a full-time writer.
You can't, or you can?
Huh?
Did you see?
No, I did. I mean, I Dick and I are long buddies, and he did. I talked him into doing his memoir, which came out as Lean But Sick, the Marine Company Commander in Vietnam. I did the writing. He taped it. I did the writing. And Dick got the idea that he did the writing.
Yeah.
A Marine.
We can write. Come on.
He then continued to keep on writing.
Well, I know, but I thought you said he didn't write.
He didn't when we started, but somehow or other he got the fever.
Wow. Wow. And so that is Dick Camp. And so he retired. Did he retire out of the Marine Corps or get out?
Oh, he retired after 26.
Okay.
Did some civilian work and then his last gig with the Marine Corps, I won't say his last sin, was operations officer, National Museum of the Marine Corps.
Oh, wow. Fairly recently.
It's fairly recent. I mean, he put a lot of the finishing touches on the building.
Wow.
He oversaw.
For those of you who've never been, if you want to go someplace where, and it's interesting talking to General Christmas about this, if you want to go to a place that has exceeded every expectation they ever had of it, go to the National Museum of the Marine Corps. It is now the Valhalla of the Marine Corps. It's an absolutely beautiful place, and what you see in there, young kids enjoy it. I took my family years ago, and the kids thought it was we're going to go so Dad can enjoy this, and they wound up having an awesome time because of all the interactive things that's there. The historical stuff that you'll see there will literally take your Marine breath away. Absolutely beautiful. And the Rotunda is the home to retirement ceremonies, commissioning ceremonies, officer candidate school graduations. So it's a sacred place now. And in talking to General Christmas, I said, did you ever envision? I didn't even get the question out of my mouth. And he said, no. He said, never envision it would be what it has become. And I think maybe one of the coolest things that has happened there, the president of South Korea, President Moon, when he came to the United States on his first official visit before he went to the White House, he scheduled a visit to the National Museum of the Marine Corps to thank the Marine Corps because he was one of the people. His mother and father were evacuated from the area of Udomnee during the Chosin Reservoir campaign. And so he went to say thank you to the Marine Corps, because were it not for the 1st Marine Division and the Marine Corps, he would not be where he is today. So pretty extremely cool. General Neller was there, said it was awesome, awesome event. So a little plug there for the work Dick Camp did. Talk to us about Kaesong. When you think of things that people should know about Kaesong, what are they?
Again, the human side of the story, the technical side of the story is fascinating because the Marines shouldn't have been doing that kind of stuff, holding a base as opposed to taking a base. It just seemed counterintuitive for Marines to be besieged rather than doing the besieging. So they really didn't know what to do. The average Marine wasn't in on the big picture thing with, you know, we're going to be staked bait. Actually, they're going to be staked bait. I'm the general. I'm going to be over here. But it became the plan. Now, I was never able to determine whether it was a plan or whether it was after the fact that they had to come up with something that looked like a plan. But there was a lot of casualties to hold a piece of ground That's really not, as I said before, not the business they were in. The business they got into was killing North Vietnamese, actually dismantling two divisions of North Vietnamese. I do want to say, overall strategically, that Tet was a major disaster for the communist forces. It's like General Joppe wrote a death sentence for his army. From 1968, after Tet, until 1972, with the invasion of the North of South Vietnam by the North Vietnamese as a standard infantry tank supported infantry invasion of a country by another country, they couldn't put enough troops together. They lost a generation dead, and had to grow a new generation of soldiers and train them between 1968 and 1972. And then 75. So overall, Tet was a disaster for the North. It was a bigger disaster for the NVA, for the Viet Cong, who were a somewhat independent force until then. And there weren't a lot of VC around Khe Sanh. The Viet Cong were ground down so far. They were used as vanguard units on assault. The North Vietnamese came in and finished up. And politically, the South became a non-entity in the future planning of the unified Vietnam. To this day, it's still a third world backwater to the North with the industrial North. And that was all caused during Tet. Now, whether that was done intentionally, or because it just happened that way, I have no idea.
No, you know, the more you read, and the interviews that you see and whatnot, you know, the Viet Cong left their villages singing, right? They were going to the puppet.
Liberate the country for themselves.
Liberate the country. The puppet army of the South was going to be vanquished. The North Vietnamese army would be behind them. They would go conduct initial operations, and then the North Vietnamese Army would come in behind them, exploit what they had done, and it did not happen that way, and they were
stopped. North Vietnamese Army was always behind them.
And ultimately was stopped and then never came, and they were stopped.
Yeah, but it was behind them not getting shot.
Oh, no, true. And so it turned into this, what this disastrous in terms of morale, not only in terms of human life, but in terms of the morale of those who were left behind, that they could not believe that this actually happened, that they were kind of left out there. And so very interesting. But Khe Sanh, very, very far from that. You know, there's no, to my...
Yeah, but if you want to take the northern two provinces, You need two victories. You need Khe Sanh, and you need Hue, because of political considerations, not necessarily military considerations. You got to use the military to get to your political situation. I mean,
but the,
war is an extension of policy. It's a method for putting policy into action. It's one method, one type of method.
I don't recall seeing a whole lot of NVA activity or Viet Cong activity in the Khe Sanh operation. Is that just me missing it or what?
No, the NVA was what was there.
Viet Cong. I don't recall.
Well, Viet Cong. No, there weren't a lot of Viet Cong.
Okay.
They had other things to do, but it was an NVA operation from start to finish. And for example, when Dick Camp got in country and was given Lima 326 in June of 1967, he led a patrol, probably more as a familiarization for the new company commander than anything else. And down in places where Marines hadn't been, you know, in low spots, not on the high ground. And they found facilities, not abandoned, but never used before, just built for a future operation that housed easily a division over the course of running into separate camps, that housed easily a division of NVA. They found rockets, B-40s and larger, I mean, all the way up to full size, you know, operational type rockets, in caves, you know, waiting to be fired. Caves were already oriented towards the base. They reported on them and never heard back. So that was, I mean, that was common before the siege, that there was going to be a siege. The groundwork had been laid. You know, it's great planning if you have the time to put it together. And they did. They had the time, the manpower, the proximity to their own bases in the north, covered by an artillery fan in the north. They had everything going for them. And, it was the logistical linchpin that the Ho Chi Minh Trail through that area. And of course, it wasn't one trail, it was a lot of trails, a trail network. But that's what they were protecting if they needed to protect anything. They were also, tying up a regiment plus a regiment and a third of Marines.
Requiring
that they have to airlift everything they eat into the base when the siege got started. All their medical supplies, all their ammunition, all the paperwork flowed out of the base by air. I mean, paper, you know, I mean, just a lot of paperwork, but they need new paper to new forms. And that had to be flown in too. The whole logistics operation had to go in by air. That ties up a lot of air. I mean, you can put all the transport helicopters you want in the world, but you got to have something bigger to protect them. Something deadlier to protect. You can see how this cascades into a major event.
You know, I do, and you can see why. I mean, when the North Vietnamese, their planners looked at it, it sets up very well for our side. Our logistics roll right through that area. You know, the caves we can use to prepare as the Americans develop that base will sustain our artillery. The approaches we can get close to them without much of an issue given the vegetation. And then one of the things that was in that documentary about Vietnam that was most amazing was the logistical effort to repair the Ho Chi Minh Trail on a nightly basis. And the young people, women, young men, young women that were out there, you know, moving dirt with baskets, you know, that were connected over their shoulder by a bamboo pole. And you wondered, how did they do that? Well, they did it with shovels and they did it with baskets. And you watch the video of it and you see the bomb craters, what we would do to it. And then you would see them go after it and begin to repair it. And you just looked at it on a daily basis and went, you gotta be kidding me.
Mirroring that though was repair to the airfield. It was taking rocket hits, mortar hits, every kind of hit. And it was steel planks that had to be brought in by air. New ones. And somebody had to go out there in a dead flat zone and repair the thing. There was the targets back on the airfield for somebody to take a shot at. And they had positions that were as close as could be. They were more or less integrated into the Marine position. Just nobody knew they were quite where they were. And, you know, people became specific targets. Just trying to keep the air base going. So it was both sides were playing that game, or got caught up in that game.
Well, I guess my observation about the Ho Chi Minh Trail was a much broader observation about the length of time that they kept that thing open.
The whole countryside to work.
Oh my God! I mean, it's just astounding when you look at it. What a B-52. an arc light could do to that terrain, and then what they would do to it to get their logistics moving through it again. Absolutely astounding. Eric, when you think of Kaysan throughout the 77 days, major events that stick out in your mind or what?
Well, the hill fights. I don't mean the hill fights of 1967. I mean the fight for each individual hill. The Vietnamese never got the high ground. Not good high ground where they could dominate anything. The tallest hill in the area was the one with the inland tower on it. By the way, yo et al to Al Gray. He was lieutenant colonel. He was in charge of that stuff at the time.
Al Gray, for those of you who don't know, pretty incredible guy. From, I want to say, private to sergeant, during the Korean War era, and
yep.
then second lieutenant to the commandant of the Marine Corps. So pretty impressive Mustang career, General Gray had. And
well, he also helped my career. He was CG of the 2nd Marine Division when Beirut happened. And Beirut was my breakout book, and he alone said, "Let this guy write it."
He is. I don't know that he gets enough credit for the intellectual life that he blew back in the Marine Corps at the end of the 80s and in the early 90s when he was when he dominated the Marine Corps. I'd never until he became commandant. When he became commandant, you asked, "Well, who is this guy?" And guys that were from the 2nd Division, everybody knew him. "Oh, General Gray, man, he's awesome." They'd tell these stories about getting punched in the chest by him in formation. And then they said, "Yeah, we don't mean just like tapped in the chest. We mean like you better lean into it or you're going on your ass getting punched in the chest." And, but he doesn't, he's this incredibly gregarious Marine kind of guy, but he also had this intellectual side to him, where he unleashes the whole discussion about maneuver warfare and really, I think, a renaissance in thinking that happened in the Marine Corps in the late 80s, early 90s, that I think took the Marine Corps to better places. And you had guys who would later that participated in that. John Kelly, now the White House Chief of Staff, John Allen, head of Brookings now. So General Gray turned that all loose.
Preceding General Gray, I don't want to leave him out because he was a good guy, it was Bob Barrow. Bob Barrow is the one that got the Marine Corps reading list off the ground. He ordered it as soon as he became commandant. He said, "This is what we're doing." And what was Gray was two or three commandants after Barrow.
General Barrow, I want to say, what was he, late 70s?
He was late 70s. Well, I can't remember his name. He was. He followed a Medal of Honor winner from Guam. His name, like Lou Wilson.
Lou Wilson.
Then there was Barrow. He was late 70s, early 80s. I met him in 79 when he was assistant commandant. I'm assuming Joe Sin.
He was a commandant of the Marine Corps, I want to say, from 79 to 83. And
something like that.
Yeah, and I joined the Marine Corps in late 83, so he was gone before I arrived. I say that to say this. Every person I've ever met that met him, that knew him, speaks of him in just the most glowing terms I've ever heard of in my life.
You're talking about Bob Barrow.
Bob Barrow, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. He made a believer of me.
Really? How did you meet him? And tell me about
him. Well, it's a funny story. I was writing Cho Sin, and he was assistant commandant, and I made an appointment with him with his flag secretary, who was Robert Johnston, who eventually got 3 stars and was chief of staff during the first Gulf War, chief of staff under I can't remember his name, Norm
Schwarzkopf.
Yeah, So I got my parking space, which was apparently deemed a miracle by everybody, and I got there. And just as I got there, Johnson took a call from somebody at the Pentagon that the assistant commandant's self was expected at a meeting that he didn't know about. So he literally gave me a hit and a lick, but he talked to people. That's the only time I ever saw him. I was in communication with him a little bit. I didn't want to bug him too hard, although there's a propensity of writers to do stuff like that. He got people to get some information. It was about Churston Reservoir. There were no records left. Nobody brought records out of the reservoir. He got me people to talk to, which is pretty selfless given the fact that he was working 24/7.
Well, General Jarvis Lynch was a major and talks about they had a day when they went into an LZ by the name of Margot, and it had been registered by NVA artillery, and they were moving the battalion into there, and they got, I guess, the majority of the battalion in there, and he and then the NVA cut loose with their artillery. He said, we medevaced 153 guys. And he said later on in the day, if you can imagine this, the helicopter Huey comes in, General Barrow, or Colonel Barrow, the regimental commander of 9th Marines, gets off the bird, and he just walks over and says, what do you need? How can I help you? And, you know, he said his presence alone, and he said he just looked at us and said, hey, they're going to pay for this. He said, you get your boys out of here, and then we're going to point our nose in the wind, and we're going to go get these guys. They're going to pay. And he said, you know, there's just, you know, the way he spoke, it was a spine stiffener, certainly for all of us. And, but it was his calmness, his matter of fact way of speaking. He'd seen, and we knew it, he had seen a lot of, shit in his life. And he was fearless. And, he said to have him descend out of the clouds. And General Lynch got very emotional. He said, it's something I'll never forget. And then he said the following morning, another Huey circles and lands on a road near the LZ, and out jumps Ray Davies.
Who was CG of the 3rd Division, and Barrow was his right-hand man when they were cleaning the division out.
Right, it's like the Valhalla of the Marine Corps opens up, right?
It's and he said, "Where heroes go to live."
Oh my God, he said, "I walked down to meet him as the opso, and we shook hands, and I looked at him, and I said, General, I don't know that it's safe for you to be out here." He said, and General Davis looked at me, and he said, "Son, this is my AO. I'll go wherever the hell I want to." And he said, "Yes, sir." He said, but again, it was, he said the same things. He said, they're going to pay for this. We're going to go get them. How are you guys doing? Do you get everybody out? Do you need anything? He said, there was just, none of the histrionics, none of the bloviating nonsense that, you know, sometimes people, can do. These guys were warriors, and they knew how to behave, in serious times, and they knew who needed to see them. And he said, truth be told, we needed to see them. The Marines that saw those guys, they'll never forget that. That they got punched in the nose. They got punched in the nose, and then these guys came down from Valhalla and looked at them and said, they're going to pay. And I said, and then what happened? And he said, they paid. He said, we went and we kicked their ass. And he said, but, you know, I'll never forget those guys coming out of the sky and giving us a spine stiffener. When he said, can you imagine medevacing better, you know, essentially a company that you just inserted? He said it was pretty sobering afternoon for all of us. So gigantic men, you know, those two guys. Interesting. Eric Hamill, my guest. He is the author of how many books?
35, 40? You count them, though.
35 or 40. He's also a friend of Dick Camp's. He's also the author of Assault on Quezon, an oral history.
He was also General Davis's aide after he got done at Quezon and saw a lot of Bob Barrow, because Barrow was Davis's truth teller.
Yeah.
So Dick was a fly on the wall for all that.
Well, you know who else? I don't know if you've ever met him. Have you ever met Barney Barnum?
No, I haven't.
Colonel Barnum was the recipient of the Medal of Honor.
Yep.
And after he received that, he went back to Hawaii, where he was TAD from, and he becomes General Lew Walt's aide. And so in the course of that, he meets Davies, he met Barrow, and he said, standing around with those guys, he said, was a privilege of a lifetime.
Oh, sure.
Privilege of a lifetime. And he said, Walt told him, you can, if you can stick it out with me for a year, you can go wherever you want in the Marine Corps. So Barnum says, okay. So after a year, he looks at Walt and he says, time for me to go. And Walt says, yeah, where do you want to go? And he says, I want to go back to Vietnam and be a battery commander. And Walt says, you can't go back there. You're a Medal of Honor guy. And he says, what do you mean? He said, General Davis did. He says, don't bring that shit up to me. He said, and so he said, it took me about a week to convince him. And then, through his word, he sent me back. And, in fact, interestingly enough, on the passing of Wesley Fox, here in the last, couple months, the battery that was firing for First Lieutenant Fox, when, his company, Alpha 19, I believe it is, fought their action where he became the recipient of the Medal of Honor. The battery firing for that was Colonel Barnum's battery. And he said, if you could have heard that guy throughout the course of the night and during the fight, not one ounce of panic in him. He said, Wesley Fox, he said, he was a Marine's Marine. And he said, my battery had the privilege of firing for him, and I'll never forget it. So interesting the links between all these the pantheon of heroes that walk in the Marine Corps. What about back to Quezon? In doing the research, anything that surprised you about the battle? I mean, because you've written, again, Chosin, Quezon, Guadalcanal, all the different things that you've written about historically relative to the Marine Corps. Did anything surprise you about
pretty much about everything. My technique is to try to pick a battle that I either don't know anything about, like Chosin. I had to find out what year it was in when I decided to do it, or that I know very little about because I like the idea of discovery.
Right.
I like coming up with having no preconceived notions. And when I do have preconceived notions, I always wind up debunking them. So maybe I'm a little weird, but the less I know, the better when I start. Because then it's all new and it's all equal.
So give me some things that in, as you did, Quezon.
Well, I mentioned rats before. I never thought of rats. Rats weren't something that, outside of trench warfare, that you give much thought to. You know, so that's a World War One. Rats are World War One. They're fascinating. But enough people talked about them and cohabiting with them was always interesting. I mean, first you get pretty sick about rats being on your food. Then after that, you're hungry. You eat the food.
All right.
I mean, that's why the military can serve such bad food when it wants to. Make everybody hungry first.
There's alternatives. The rats.
Yeah, I mean, that's strategic thinking.
There you have it. No, you're true. You're right.
Also a good way to turn the food over in the food lockers.
There you go. What about, give me something else that surprised you as you did research for Quezon?
I got this thing about the, I'm going to blank here. When I was talking about, I don't know what I was talking about. Hold on a second. Let me pull myself together. Being under the gun, being staked bait. I didn't think of it that way until, I can't remember the name of the general. Tommy Tompkins. Rats von Tompkins. Until General Tompkins brought it up, I had given no thought at all to the state bait aspect of the campaign, of drawing the North Vietnamese in to kill them, to basically let them hold your belt buckle while you were smashing his face in.
Did he suggest that was a strategy, or is that simply...
Yeah, well, I asked him for final words. I asked a lot of people for final words that are in the book, at the back of the book, and that was his contribution. Was that, you know, I don't remember, it looked like a foot away from me, but I don't have time to go through pages. But I believe he said that it was preconceived. I don't think it was. Maybe it was, but that's what he claimed. I mean, after the fact, it was after the fact because it was after the war. But that was all him.
Interesting. Is there, you know...
Not like that ever happened before in history.
Yeah, exactly. An anomaly. The talk about, less than 60 days after the fighting ends.
The base was plowed under.
The base was plowed under and abandoned. Was there any lingering sense among the people you spoke to and used in your book? Bitterness? I mean, that...
Yeah, there were a lot of pissed off people. They felt that they, from their perspective, they gave it all to defend the base, to make it a permanent fixture, to secure it, resecure it. Personally, I'm just sitting here thinking, why would they have done that? Well, there's always a political reason for doing it, but I think a lot of unexploded ordnance would be a good excuse for plowing a whole base under. Can you imagine how much exploded ordnance there would have been in the D-ring in Quezon?
There would have been a bit.
Just a bit. Not to mention what Marines would have left behind on their own. In spite of all the training.
Right. Now, I think those of us who have fought in Iraq have had the same feeling when ISIS overran Fallujah and Ramadi of what the hell did we go there for? You know, it's now in...
Yeah, but you've got that in Korea. You've got that in a lot of places. Right. I mean, you know, we never did much good for the Pacific Islanders either.
Well, we did better than the Japanese.
Well, just a little.
Yeah, so, I mean, we have done some good things. But
I'm saying that there's always, you know, when you're a destructive force,
yeah,
for whatever good reasons and good intentions, you're still a destructive force. I mean, you change people's lives, not necessarily for the better in some of those places. I mean, Stadio, for example, by all accounts, is a slum. The little island itself has way more people than it can carry, because I don't know why.
Yeah, there probably is no good reason.
Hmm?
There probably is no good reason. I mean, the only reason that thing ever got famous was because the Japanese decided to build an airfield.
Right.
Right.
And we decided to take it.
And if other than that, would anybody even... Does it have any significance that...
It's got no significance and will soon be underwater.
Right. The Eric, a couple final questions for you. When you look for an enduring legacy for the Battle of Quezon, Siege in the Clouds, what is its enduring legacy?
Another place the Marines stood fast. Like I said, nobody told them, gave them a good official reason for being there, but it was good enough. Generals made their decision. There was something there. Now let's defend it. And then let's carry the war to the enemy. Because the last thing that happened during the siege was the breakout, which is unseaging Quezon and going after the hills that the NVA did have, going after the valleys that they didn't have it used for moving around.
Tell us
ground
about,
attack.
Tell us about.
Sure.
Yeah, tell us about that. There's one of the Marines in Bravo Company 126 did a documentary called Bravo! Exclamation mark, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. And I watched it. And one of the things he does throughout, he told me, he sent me a copy, and his name's Ken Rogers. He's a Lance Corporal there. And there's artillery going off throughout the whole documentary. And about 15 minutes into it, you're like, do we really need that shit in the background? Stop it. You know, now my dog's under the bed, right? And he told me, turn, you know, watch it on with a good sound system and turn it up. Don't have it down quiet. And so I thought, 77 days of that, those guys can't be right in the head.
Oh, it makes you dingy.
Right. But one of the most riveting parts of the documentary is when they talk about the breakout, when they went and attacked, where they had lost, I want to say, over 50 Marines relatively early. I think they call it the Ghost Patrol, 126 does. But
yeah, sure.
They went, and to hear them talk about, you know, they got up during the hours of darkness. They moved to their line of departure, and then when they were there, the order was given to fix bayonets. And to hear them talk about them looking at what? Fixed bayonet.
Oh, hearing the sound of the bayonet being driven home.
Right, hearing guys rustling to find their bayonet in their little day pack or whatever, and hearing it click, and then guys looking left to right, and they said, we knew it was going to be on, but because of the cloud cover, the NVA did not see us coming, and we were on top of them, essentially, before they knew it. And to hear them talk about with such vividness, it's like it's interesting in terms of, you know, it might be 50 years according to the calendar. When you watch those guys talk about it, they're reliving it as they do it. It's pretty incredible. And so tell us about your recollections with the guys you talked to about those operations.
Well, you get those little moments. I mean, bayonets, you know, click, 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 all your metal. 77 days of artillery. Well, you had battery plus in the base itself. In fact, a very good photograph of one of the 105s being fired is on the cover of the new book, one I'd never run across before. I just found a little trove of color photographs. You got moments like that. You got moments where you don't know how you got where you got in one piece, but people sort of consider that to be good news.
Right.
Funny thing about that. So you can go through more of the siege. I will tell you that I saw deeper, longer PTSD in the caisson beds than in any other group of soldiers or sailors or airmen that I ever ran across, even more than Guadalcanal, which was longer and filthier, but not as – and bombed every day. But, I mean, those guys still talk with a limp, you might say.
No, if you watch that documentary, as I said – and I'm not joking about my dog being under the bed or anything like that – he does a great job with the audio. I don't know who his, he told me who his sound guy was. He's a big time Hollywood guy who saw a bit of it and said,
need surround sound.
Yeah. I'd love to help you out with this. But 77 days of that, 77 days of medevac and your friends, and you know, obviously wrestling with your own mortality, as guys come and go, and you don't know if you're going to make it or not. But again, it's different than being on the offensive, yes, in terms of, you know, you feel, much of the time helpless. You know, I don't know if I'm going to wear one of these things today, but I guess I'll go out and fill sandbags like everybody else.
Yeah. Well, let me read you a passage that I came across, just before you call to get me on the air. This is what guys who haven't been in combat for 10 minutes think when their security goes away. So the guy who's talking is Dennis Mannion, who is a forward artillery observer with Charlie Battery 113 working with Kilo 326 on Hill 861. And this is when the assault phase literally began. He's with his radio man, his name is Dave. Just before Dave and I were ordered south to the landing zone, Malcolm Mole, was an all-around decent guy. He wasn't the biggest guy around, but he did his job on all the patrols. I was ever on with him. He wanted to be a radio DJ when he got out of the Navy. I guess he was a corpsman. Yeah, he was a corpsman. He was always going around practicing his DJ voice and using radio sayings. So just before Dave and I were ordered south to the landing zone, Malcolm had talked from the 3rd Platoon trench line to use a fairly elaborate shitter that was just to the right of our bunker. Dave and I had seen him come out of the mist, and we had tensed. But he had identified himself with that radio DJ voice, and we had laughed out loud at that. We spoke to him for a few minutes, and then Captain Jasper called to tell him the fight was on. Apparently, the MVA opened up as Malcolm was walking back down to the northern trench line after using the shitter. He was caught out in the clear. There wasn't much left to identify him. That's the kind of stuff.
In 77 days of that. That's one episode in one day.
One little episode in one day.
Right.
Only one guy got killed.
Right. In that instance. And what I'm thinking of a phrase out of military literature that says hell in a very small place. Do you remember what that reference is?
Yeah, Bernard Fall.
Right.
Dan Benfu.
Kaesong. Right. With all the, Eric, talk about the national intention that went with Kaesong. Right. It was, the nation, you know, Kaesong surrounded. Yada 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 yada. The president being informed on a, you know, multiple times every day about the progress.
Yeah, well, he was pushing himself to the forefront. I had to figure out a way to get him to stop calling in. The president, that is.
Yeah. No. Do you write anything about that?
No, I'm very much. You know, there in the battlefield. If I have to go farther afield, I do. But
right.
I'm really interested in the soldiers' war.
Interesting. All right. Final question. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about Kaesong that you think is significant that you want to let people know?
I think we covered it. I think we covered it for an hour broadcast.
All right. Well, first of all, sir, I always love having you on here, and whether we're talking about the craft of riding or Marine Corps history or almost parallels between different battles, it's always fun for me to have somebody who's done the kind of work that you've done in your career. Honestly, I know you'll recoil at this, but a legend in the Marine Corps in terms of everybody knows the name Eric Hamill. Because any Marine bookstore you go into, you see that.
They've all borrowed money from
you. You've seen that name all over the place. So thank you very much. In a few weeks that we will pay attention once again to the deeds of Marines who once again, like our last conversation about the Chosin Reservoir. It's a unique group of human beings throughout its history, and when they get pushed, they tend to push back in a big way, and I think that's what makes Marines special. And you, as our unofficial historian, probably know that better than anybody. But thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you for having me. In a couple of weeks, we'll do Way City.
There you have it. The 50th anniversary is coming up, and books being released, and so we'll have Eric back, and we'll talk about Voice City. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global SOF Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.